all the rest. Mike, Kyo?
Peter was, I guess.
So there are two similarly named and kind of related properties at play here. One is application idle detection mode, and the other is user idle detection mode. User idle detection mode is going to be the more common one, I think. This is where your application is interacting with the user, even though the user might not be touching the screen. So an example of this would be an accelerometer-based app where they're shaking the phone but they're not touching the screen, or a turn-by-turn navigation app where the screen stays on even though the user isn't touching it. For those cases, you disable user idle detection, which means the phone won't try and detect that the user isn't using the phone and turn on the lock screen. But you should only do that while you are actually presenting useful information to the user. If you stop presenting useful information to the user or they stop shaking your phone, you should then re-enable user idle detection and the phone will lock. The phone will also lock automatically if the battery becomes low or some other kind of edge case happens. The second type, which I think this question is asking about, is the application idle detection mode, and this is going to be a rarer case, and this is where you want your application to continue running even after the phone is locked, the screen is turned off, the user's put the phone in their pocket. This is the one that does have more stringent ingestion requirements around power usage and so on, and there are really only a handful of scenarios where this type of application really makes sense. There are applications that do large downloads in the background. There are applications that continue to play music or other media in the background. Or there are applications that might track you using GPS, for example, in the background. But these ones are far less common than the user idle detection applications. And your application will get tested for power consumption and ingestion. And if you use too much power, the application will be rejected. So you should do things like stop all your dispatch timers and threading timers, stop all your animations, stop everything you're doing that isn't absolutely critical to the feature of your app that needs to run while under lock screen. That's the best practice for that.
And the general guidance is you shouldn't be using it unless you have a really good reason for it.
Exactly, yeah.
We really don't want folks to build apps that run under the lock screen. That's not the general pattern.
Yeah, so a great anti-example is you decide that you don't want to implement tombstoning and it takes too long to boot your app if the user unlocks. If you simply try and disable application idle detection so that your app appears instantly, you will not get through certification because that is not a valid usage of this feature.
So to be clear, if anyone is going to try to use any of those APIs, we're going to take extra looks at the application during the ingestion process, which basically is the app certification process.
Now, I think our certification guideline actually requires that you notify the user as well if you're going to take advantage of this.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you are a media playback app, you are not required to notify the user because it's kind of obvious you're playing media. If you're any other kind of app, the nuances of the guidelines are changed recently, but essentially it will be disclosed in Marketplace. You are highly encouraged, if not required, to disclose it in your app, and you are highly encouraged, if not required, to have an explicit opt-in, opt-out experience. But I don't know the final wording. That should be published.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of some of the hidden things in our Marketplace certification requirements that we want to expose more clearly in the future so that people are aware of a lot of these things, where you have to actually do additional work in order to make sure you meet the guideline.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. I hope answer the question. So we had another question coming in from Lawrence, and he asked a general question regarding isolated storage. Does the framework support serialized objects? And the answer is yes. Like AIM.NET, you can do that with XML serializable.
Well, there's also the built-in isolated storage setting class, which is basically a name value pair dictionary built on top of isolated storage and does it for you automatically.
Right. So let's get to it. So then what are the pros and cons of reading and writing from isolated storage and serialized objects from isolated storage and so forth? So I guess Mike, as you mentioned, there are like two different scenarios. One is for studying, it is where you have something built in into the platform. Well, if you can explain about that. And then the other one is general serialization, like the storage pros and cons.
So isolated storage setting is just a wrapper class around isolated storage. The idea is it exists in Silverlight Prosper as well. It's really easy to use. It's the name value pair dictionary. You just write to it and then call basically save the isolated storage and it deserializes for you, which is nice. And then of course there's normal serialization, which that wrapper uses effectively with the covers. The pros of serialization are tend to be easy. The cons are less flexibility. Perhaps performance concerns depending on what you're serializing, you could potentially do it faster yourself. And there's also the persisting issue, right? If you want to modify the objects in a new version, if they're your types, you can hit versioning issues if you're kind of careful about adding fields and properties to those things you're serializing. So it's, I think the same as .NET, basically.
I guess. So, all in all, I think the answer is yes, we support serialization on objects. We have multiple, ways to implement that, pick and choose and verify really what you want to do.
I mean, one thing I do want to add is if your app intends on doing heavy serialization and deserialization, you definitely want to test on a device to be sure the performance characteristics are in line with what you expect, because the emulator doesn't go as well at really emulating hardware speeds on the device.
Of course. And to that, if we are already talking about that, I don't exactly know if we have any questions, any other questions regarding that specific topic. But what would you say about serialization or digital, or actually reading from storage or fetching large amounts of data during obligation startup? What is our guidance there? How do we want to mitigate any loading times or any patterns that we can offer in order to allow application to load whatever it needs to load?
Is this the first opportunity to plug the first doc?
Yes, I guess.
Okay. Then we will use this opportunity to plug the first doc. There's a link to it from the Windows Phone developer blog, I believe. Basically, as we...
Three entries down.
Three entries down, as Larry said. As we've worked help make a platform and then make apps good on the platform, we've found a bunch of tips and tricks. Everything we've learned is captured in that doc. If your app is slow and you haven't read that doc, you're leaving turf on the table. So read that, make changes to your app. It will get better. Yes,
yeah.
And that is a living document. We keep adding to it as we learn more. The general rule you want to do as little as possible in startup before you show your first frame. So you effectively want to do almost nothing but show, obviously have a splash screen, so that's shown instantly, and then have as little as possible before you present your first frame to the user. And then what you want to do is basically show them some sort of loading screen. If you're going to make a network request, if you're going to load a bunch of data from isolated storage, if you're going to do anything, make sure you do that on a background thread and show progress to the user. So the UI thread is always free to continue rendering and be interactive. The general guide.
This is also where you would plug the fast progress bar indicator.
Yes.
From Jeff's
blog.
One thing I'd add there is, around tombstoning, be sure to separate transient state that you need for an application's current instance from permanent state that you would actually store in isolated storage. If you find yourself storing all transient state on disk, you're going to pay an unnecessary performance penalty. Instead, you should use the property bag off of the phone application service object or the individual page object.
So, we'll get to tombstoning probably a little bit later. But I think what you're saying here is just make sure that you don't serialize, let's say, isolated storage, everything. Just be careful what you're using, just any data objects that are actually
really important
related to your application,
right,
versus anything that is, UX-driven or anything that is for the concurrent application. Right.
Cool.
Okay, can we take a quick break just to reset the video? We'll just take a second.
Sure.
Okay. The audio.
Small recess. Quick recess.
Quick recess. The audio might go out with it here at the same time.
You did a couple of blog interviews about tombstoning not too long ago.
Did you talk
about the property bag at that point?
Yeah.
Okay.
And obviously those need to be updated now for the RGM. There are some mild differences there. On the audio? We can leave it on the audio. Mild, yeah.
We checked,
yeah. Yep. So another question for Peter, I guess. Team asked about the application bar. Are we able to use text as resources? And I guess the more important question here is about multiple languages, because we do offer the phone in multiple languages.
Yeah, so I think the root of this problem is can you use data binding on the application bar same way that you would use in your Tableau UI? The answer to that is no. In Windows Phone 7, the application bar does not participate in data binding and so on. If you want the guts of why that is, there is a post on my blog about why the application bar isn't a framework element. But you can still use code to, you know, load the right resources and then put them into the application bar. But you will need a placeholder string. If you're creating your application bar in XAML, you'll need a placeholder string, such as a full stop or something like that, so that you can add the buttons to the buttons collection. Then you can insert the correct text. Or if you're creating the application bar entirely in code, you can just create the, you can just add the correct text at the time you construct the buttons and add them to the buttons collection. So technically it's possible, but it's not as clean as you might expect.
Cool. Thanks, Peter. Another question we had, or we had a few questions about the tiles. Obviously the first and main question is how can we create our own animated tiles like the Xbox? And then do we get multiple tiles for a single application? And another question was, how can we get the large tile? And care one cares to answer? I can answer. Okay. So for this version, unfortunately, the answer to all the questions is right now no. Developers will only get the small tiles, the square one, and only one tile per application. But we might make some changes in the future. Who knows? Cool. So here's another perf question, or perf-related questions. Question was, I'm developing a library for Windows Phone for memory, and he was the class was he's looking for some memory profiling tools, and I guess at that point we can open a whole discussion about the tools that we have, the counters, the frame counters, and in general the serial counters that we have, and how can we, you know, mitigate that.
So currently we don't have any memory profiling tools, but what we have seen is people write their own controls that use the device extended properties to spit out the device memory, total memory, and the application current memory, and the application speed memory, and they keep they use that in combination with the frame rate counters. So we have a flag called enable frame rate counters. In that there's a counter for memory texture memory. So they use that in combination, like these counters are used in combination to figure out what your app memory usage is. And we have seen customers use that efficiently and have been able to track memory leaks and narrow down the problems. At the same time, there are other counters that we would want to stress, which are listed in the performance document, which is like frame rate counters, then there's read or region counters, and cache visualization, which highlights what textures are being transferred onto the GPU. So it's highly recommended that performance document is supposed to be read and
thoroughly. Right. And in the new tool, I mean, the RTM tools template itself also enables the frame rate counters, right? And
yeah.
And the two other counters are basically there in the constructor. They're just commented out.
So there's one slight thing I want to point out, is that if you do use the device extended properties to get your peak memory and your current memory, remove them before you submit to the marketplace, because your application will be flagged in marketplace as needing access to the device's information, which may cause the user who potentially would purchase your application to think twice about purchasing it. So remove those calls to device extended properties before you submit to marketplace.
Sure.
Also, those memory numbers could be skewed if the garbage collection has not kicked in. So make sure that if you want really accurate data, then you kick off the garbage collection every now and then.
But did we mention that there are requirements here in the certification requirements around memory usage? So you are going to have to touch on this at some point.
So we have not, but I think, Larry, now that you mentioned it, it's a good
I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but there are.
Some numbers, remember?
90 megabytes?
It's a special number.
Yeah.
Does it vary based on how much memory the phone has?
No, because different phones might have different amounts of memory. There's a minimum bar, but the...
Is this on the minimum?
Yeah.
2.5 meg is the minimum phone.
So the question is, so if you have a phone with more, can you have it bigger?
So,
in
theory, yes.
But then you can flag in the market, that's right.
In theory, yes, but I don't know if we have enough details to say that right now.
Okay, so 90?
Yes.
90. Good number.
I think the interesting thing I've seen is that even if people have a compressed image, maybe it's a 16K JPEG, you know, at runtime, that's actually an uncompressed image. And so although you think it's 16 kilobytes, it's actually much larger in memory on the device. So if you have hundreds of images, that's a lot more memory than people really understand they are using.
Correct.
So just be cognizant that memory goes up really fast with media.
Can you add some current issues that we have seen?
Sure.
So Bing map controls, when we use that with more layers, that is tend to use more memory. So it's advisable that when you're panning or clicking, like hide the extra layers that you have, use only the Bing map control layer.
Okay. And as far as using the specific APIs for the control and patterns, do we have that somewhere reported? I mean, do we have it in the doc? Someone has written the blog about it already, or
we're
still working on it?
We have it in the next change that will go out in the performance document. It should be out. I can send that out right now.
I think device extended properties are in some blog posts.
Yes, we are looking at beer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hand it to your commission, Peter. another question, Civilized. The controls, I found the panorama sometimes animates when it first appears, but most of the time it does not. And then the following question was, is there any way to control that, you know, to control the animation and transition? So there are two separate questions about the panorama. One is performance related, and the other one is not. So who wants to take the first one?
Sure.
All right. Sure. So I can take the what's being animated when you don't see anything question.
Okay.
And it's a little funny. It's actually animating a black square, probably. And it's doing a beautiful job of sliding it in. And the reason for that is that if you have a complex, you know, application there, the layout path hasn't happened yet. So it's still trying to figure out where the buttons and the list box and everything should be sized. In the meantime, it animates in the black background toward the white background, and that's what happens. So you never see it. What can you do to fix it?
Well, I guess the question would be why, to begin with. I mean, what causes this effect? I mean, what's the root cause for that?
Well, the panorama at this point is already loaded. So it says, hey, I have something, I'm going to do my introductory animation. The trouble is that there's no way to know is everything on the page laid out for this animation to appear. So the best thing you can do is just simplify. Get rid of what's on your panorama items at startup. Maybe just have it limited to your headers and basic text, but don't do all your data binding for like Twitter feeds or friends lists.
Up front.
Because then it can still, you know, animate in some of that. You know, but if you have four different panorama items, you have, you know, friends list, Twitter feeds, all those things, it's just hundreds of items that need to be laid out before that happens.
And basically what you are saying is that even if panorama have several panels, it's still going to start pipeline all of them.
Right. And that's because, first of all, there's always a hint of the next panorama item. And the way that it wraps, actually the animation shows the last item kind of sliding off screen to show you the first item.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, we have to do a lot of calculations for all the items.
Right. So basically what we're saying is if you are going, you know, I would even go to the extreme and someone going to do some IO calls, I mean, web requests or whatever for, you know, populating data.
Yep.
So this is obviously we want to, you know, hold up all the, you know, painting on the screen or showing it.
Yeah. A related point to that was, am I right thinking the pivot control, you actually only have to load, like, the focus panel and the one either side of it.
Yeah,
so if you have more than that, they you don't need to load them up front.
Yeah, so the pivot control actually just loads the single item at first. So you'll see it appear as fast as possible, and then it'll optimistically try to load additional items as it can. But that's definitely going to have a quicker startup time as a result. Yeah.
So the second question about the panorama was, is there any way to control or customize transition animation in the panorama?
Not today, right?
Not easily. You could try to do some magic in the XAML. You know, and you can become a blend expert, I guess, and you could try to have a startup trigger. You cancel the whole thing, right? Yeah, it's just a lot of work. So I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm sure somebody will. You know, some people get really picky about the UX of their apps, and I'm sure people will hopefully share their experience when they do it.
Right.
But that's something I'll do.
But for the boss that said, I guess the recognition was not to do that, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So we mentioned the first doc, and I guess all the XML answer, actually most of it will get answered. One of the questions that just came in is, someone mentioned that we have will have in the future different phone with different resolutions. And then the question was, if we design Silverlight apps for the current resolution, will they scale down automatically to the smaller resolution device when they roll out? Even if we use Dimension 4 controls.
Yeah. So we have officially announced that there is another resolution on the horizon. There is no official supporter tool for that resolution right now, so it is not possible to build an app that can work on that right now. I believe, Larry, what the official guidance was, I think it was some number of months before those phones would be available. We had tooling for that. I think it was in the 3 or 4 month range.
Right. We had been promised that if and when we announce the new resolution will be available. We have officially, I mean, and Nick, we said a new resolution will come at some point, and that remains the case. Before we do that, we will provide tooling.
It's probably the marketplace submissions that say that your app has to support all of the available resolutions. So
it's a bug in the submission.
Well, you know, I'm thinking, okay, 800x480, we can do that.
Right, only one available, so yeah, x equals one. So yeah.
The other thing is the case, though, where right now you could at least, if you use the text files and the files built in the phone and proper layout, you can at least avoid the pain later.
Yeah, that was wrote something on that to come out of my mouth. Where if you use the built-in control templates and you use the built-in styles, not just for colors and brushes, but also for text styles like large, extra large, medium, etc., you will be best set up for different screen resolution, and also using alignment versus absolute pixel positioning and stuff like that. You'll be better set up. Obviously, when the tools come out and so on, you'll still have to test your app and might need to modify it, but you'll, in theory, have less work to do if you rely on the resources and kind of automatic layout rather than if you hard code, my font is 20 pixels and it's 15 pixels from the edge of the screen, stuff like that.
Right.
A very firm theory.
Because for if we take XNA for example, I guess the transition will be a little bit easier on that, right?
Yeah, the hardware scaler should work its magic, and it should just work. He said dangerously.
So. Yeah. So I got another question about a status bar and the application bar. Is there a possibility to change the background color of the status bar or the application bar?
Application bar, yes. You can change the foreground and the background. Only the solid colors. You can't put like an image brush or gradient brush on them. They're just solid colors. And it will do the treatment of the circle and the icons and so on and invert them when you tap them. At the moment, the status bar, no. That's an area that we know we want to improve on. But at the moment, the status bar is either visible or invisible. And it's the theme color.
And is there any way to set transparency on the application bar?
Application bar, yes. You have the option to go anything from 0%, which only shows the buttons and the menus and no background, all the way through to 100%. The guideline, though, is not to just pick a random number, but to either go 0, 50, or 100%, rather than say, I'm going to be 73.5% today and 14.2% tomorrow. So please don't choose random numbers.
Okay. So I guess that's basically all the questions we've pretty much gathered from today. And I'll turn in to you guys and ask.
When you go over that second last
one,
the music automatically paused.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So there's another question. Yeah, and we can introduce to the tombstone as well. Is music automatically paused when the phone calls
come in and resume when the call ends, or declines, or do we need to stop and restart in the deactivated and activated event handlers?
So it's a good question, and it looks like there's maybe a couple of questions tied in with this one, so I'll try to separate them. One is, what happens when your application is running and a phone call comes in? What are the events you get? You do not get a deactivated and activated. You actually get a separate set of events called obscured and unobscured. Your application continues running. That's not tombstone or things like this. We do ask that your application in those cases limit the amount of work it's doing. In the case of audio, I'll assume that the media element is being used here, in which case the media element itself will automatically pause. So there shouldn't need to be any additional handling for that case around media by the developer. But yeah, just to be clear, deactivate and activate do not fire in that case. You get obscured and unobscured.
Okay. Got another question here. When to support the exit functionality of Serverlize, and I guess the proper question would be, is there a way to exit Serverlize application today?
Not today.
And if not, how the user should, I guess I would, you know, enlarge the question, say, how would user react to the, you know, pressing on the start button? The Windows button. The middle button. Yeah.
I mean, that is the equivalent of shutting an app down. You get the right events and you shut down. Right.
Right. So
I think the question there seems to be about how application or exhibit, I believe, still force supports, right, Mike?
No. Not yet. That's the one I had to apply to.
Right.
So there is no way to exit your app through code.
Right. Right.
It doesn't exist.
So there is. Right question.
That will result in a Watson law that you're going to have to deal with eventually. You got a different problem. You do that, you get Watson dumps, and then somebody will contact you for Watson dumps.
So this is another thing. I have a blog post on my blog. It's blogs.msn.com/ptorr, if anyone cares. I do talk about this lack of exit in Silverlight. And there's some theory behind it too. The kill said, if you hit start, you should go to the start menu. And the user doesn't have to worry about your application anymore. If they back pass your application exit automatically, they don't have to worry about your application anymore. And we haven't yet found scenarios that actually require the application to have, in the middle of its UI, an exit button that instantly causes the application to move.
Yeah, there's a hardware version, right? The third button.
But that doesn't terminate your app, right? That leaves it around if you want to get back to it. It doesn't exit the app. It tombstones it, right?
So Peter is right. The real thing here is we haven't found a scenario where it is a requirement. And certainly something that we're thinking about, but driven by, the lack of a concrete requirement.
This takes care of all the data for you, right?
That's why we require it. That's why we changed that.
So I guess from what you're saying is that folks should consider tombstoning and the deactivated event as if their application is basically being closed.
No.
There's a closing event on the phone application service.
Right.
That tells you that you are no longer an application that's active in the system.
However,
that happens when the user hits the back key from the first page of the application.
First instance, first page in the application.
Yeah.
There's a rule about that in the XNA, isn't there? If they hit the back on the top level, you must exit your game at that point, and I guess that finds across the Silverlight as well, in a similar kind of way.
Yeah, in some way you kind of get it for free,
yeah.
In a sense, unless you block the back button, which we wouldn't want people to do. So in that case, you don't get it deactivated. In that case, you get closing.
Right.
If you start at any point while that case, so you get deactivated.
Right. But what I was suggesting is that there is no exit button. Our assumption that if someone wants to just quit an application, you will press the start button.
Yeah.
You get to the start screen.
Yep.
And you would get a deactivated event. You have no idea if the user will actually press the back button to go back to your application or relaunch it again or whatever.
That's right.
So when you get a deactivated event, you should assume that the user will not return to your application if you want to persist in the data or take any action that would allow it to carry on the functionality or the state of the app for the next application invocation.
And correct, it's even more important because it a user may take a common route to get back to your app is going through the start screen. So you get deactivated, and when that person goes to start and starts your app again, you'll actually
launching it
and you'll start fresh. So
I would just add on to that. It shouldn't assume that the user will return to your app, but you shouldn't discount that possibility either. And a lot of bugs we see with applications happen because the developer assumes that in deactivated, nobody's ever going to come back to me. Or vice versa. They assume that they'll come back, but don't come back. So they don't save enough state, for example. The reality is, unless you're a mind predictor, which I certainly am not, you won't know in advance, and so you have to account for both possibilities. So that's why our guidance says, use the state property bags to store transient information and use the persistent storage to store persistent information in your deactivated handlers as needed.
And an even more subtle nuance on Neil's point, which is that if you get deactivated, the user may never come back to that instance, or you may get activated. Another kind of family of bugs we found is that developers assume that once they've got deactivated, their process will be terminated, and then before they get a new activated, their app will be constructed, their page will be constructed, all these other code bits will run, the startup event will fire, and so on. But in the case of certain launches and chooses which don't tombstone the application, or in the case that the user hits start or the screen locks, and they realize they didn't mean to do that, and they go back to your application before you finish deactivating, we will reactivate you without terminating the application. So we've seen bugs where in deactivated, developers do stuff like shut down network connections or null out objects that only get created during the application constructor or like a page constructor, and then the app falls over because we fire the activated event again and we fire the navigated event again, but they needed to run code in the constructors, which hasn't run because the object never died.
Like a race condition?
It's not necessarily race. You're right. The fact that you came back while it wasn't dead yet is a race condition. And so that's why our guidance is also don't use the Silverlight startup event. Don't put stuff in your constructors unless you're not going to destroy them in the deactivated event. But really rely on the activated, the launching, and the navigation event, and rely less on exclusive constructors.
Which launchers and choosers did we change to not tombstone?
So that's a good question. I'll caveat by saying for certain launchers and choosers, we do not automatically tombstone the application.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that your application will never be tombstone in those cases.
Okay.
If, for example, when you try to take a photo, or
you still be able to handle that event and then occur?
Only to handle the worst case.
Okay.
We just by default don't auto tombstone the application.
So, and that's a performance?
And that's a user experience performance.
Okay.
People who've been using the mixed builds ever since then are used to a really bad scenario there. We improve that at RTM, but developers should not go away from the earlier practice.
I think that changed between beta and RTM, didn't it? That particular one?
Yeah.
The guidance continues to be that you need to be able to handle the tombstoning event, even in the event of a launcher chooser fire. So,
there's two things that Peter said that I wanted to touch upon. It's independent of tombstoning. First of all, don't have any constructors. That's general goodness even for performance from a XAML perspective. Every XAML element that's really heavy incurs parse cost and startup cost. And second, a navigated event by itself, if you make that too heavy, then your page won't show up forever and you'll get large lags in transitions. So general recommendation is to not populate large amounts of content. Treat navigated to like startup. Essentially, don't bring up your entire scenes on that event. So it's a blocking call and your UI will just stall.
So I guess the general guidance is treat constructor respectively, right? Don't do tons of logic within them.
The constructor.
It's a constructor. Use the launching, activated, deactivated, and closing events if you want to do any, I wouldn't say heavy lifting of your objects, but if you have like any data single zones or any managers that you want to initialize or they are global to the app, this is where you would do it. And then on the navigate to the page, you want to have page-specific data or UI constructed with it.
Yeah. Tony Kill says don't put everything in Tony Navigator events, but treat that as the indication that you've been navigated to, not the constructor.
I think it's about private plane time, guys, if that's okay. We're finishing at 4, is that right?
Yeah, so we are pretty much wrapping up.
Private plane?
Private plane, yeah. We have a giveaway.
It's a tradition in these jumpstarts that we made. I made a bad joke at the very first one. They implied you might get a private jet if you took part in the actual course. We've had to deliver these, and so we now have a private jet. You have to build it yourself. I can rattle it. You can figure out how big it's going to be. And what we do in this is basically we ask a very, very simple question. You change your seat color to match whether you think the answer is true or false. Purple is true. Yellow is false. And the question is, Andy?
Is it true or false? Silverlight uses an additional, uses an additional composite thread to execute simple animations on the GPU, the graphics processing unit.
Is that the answer?
No, you guys, nobody in this room's allowed to win the plane. You want to buy your own from the Lego shop like I did. So we're getting some color change. We'll give you the right answer in a couple of seconds, and then we'll pick... pick an appropriate color. I nearly said the color. We'll pick a color, and then somebody will have a private jet delivered to their door.
Right. So, using this time, I want to thank everyone made the effort to come and join us here. Remember, thank you very much. Most of you do write publicly, or at least some of you write in blogs, right? So you can follow up. We'll do write some summary of the question. I know there are some questions that we haven't answered. Some of those questions are future-related or feature-related, so we're not going to be address those here. And for the specific questions that we have answered, we will summarize them and, I guess, post them somewhere. Cool?
Okay. Let's pick a winner. The answer to the question, Andy, is
true.
Absolutely true. So anybody that put purple is a potential winner. And so now I'm going to use my random mouse hand. Sounds a bit strange. Pick a name, and it's Darren, D-A-R-R-I-N. So if you can put a question up with your full contact details, with an address we can post the plane to, then in the merest hint of time, or maybe a week, whichever's longer, then you'll get yourself a plane sent through. Thank you very much for taking part in the competition. Sorry for the rest of the guys that couldn't win, but you can't all win, I'm afraid. That's the way that life is arranged. So thank you very much. And what we're going to do now is hand back to Libby. So thank you for that, and thank you, everybody.
Well, thank you all to all the guys. Hopefully they'll mute the phone on that end, and so without too much trouble, I can be heard. We're going to do some last bit of polling before we go. Let's start with this one. Overall, how satisfied are you with this session? And go ahead and vote directly on the slide. No more changing your seat color. For this one, vote on the slide. Click next to the box that corresponds to your answer. And in a moment before you all go, I am going to launch a survey. We're hoping that you could take a few minutes to fill it out. You only have to do it once. You will receive an email with the link as well tomorrow or the next day. So hopefully you take a minute now to do it. How was the pace of this course? The three choices, too fast, just right, or too slow. See that the overwhelming majority of folks thought it was just right. I'll always like that. Give it another minute, seconds, move on to the last poll. And just for our peace of mind, we're wondering if you registered for part one of today's session, or just part two. Give you a chance to answer this question again in the survey, where we'll ask if you did register for both. So don't worry if you registered for both. That's not an option on this one. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and launch the survey. Take me a moment. And I'm going to ask you to take a moment. Click on the link that you'll find under the registered online. Or if you did not register online, use the second link. And that will launch the survey right on your computer where you can fill it out. Once you're done with that, just close it and that will submit it or select the submit button. I suspect there might be a complete or something like that. We definitely appreciate that. But with that, we will conclude the audio portion of our meeting. We'll leave this survey link up for you for a little while, so take your time. But that does conclude our meeting. Thank you all for joining us. We look forward to doing this again soon. You may now disconnect from the conference.